Throwing in that pledge of support to KPFT, you feel great, but guess what? Your job, it's not done just yet. You still need to fulfill your promise to KPFT by sending that pledge payment today. And when you do, you take that often forgotten last step. Don't wait any longer. KPFT depends on you.
Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals 8 p.m. Thursday. And time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and it's right here on a listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Hank Rubichek, and alongside a team saturated in talent, Greg Audell, Drs. Warren Holloman and Mary Edgerton, an ace engineer and media maven, Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on astonishing journeys before returning us safely to the present. You know, every week, Tatiana delivers information about our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. And tonight, three members from the Guild are here to share a few insights about Houston's premier storytellers group. But mostly, they're here to tell stories in their impressive signature styles. Each has been on before, but tonight, they formed a posse to round up some excellent stuff. They are Sheila Starks Phillips, Alan Gardner Atkinson, and Michael Winters. Welcome, all of you. Let's hear your voice. Let everybody know that you're here.
Thank you, Hank.
All right, very good. Wonderful. Let's get to some stories. Well, award-winning storyteller Dr. Michael Winters is always a hit with his tales of introspection. His knack for laughing at himself makes both him and his parable special, like the story when he reveals in his family that he's a family and marriage counselor, and a darn good one, and then unveils the failure of his first marriage that lasted a whopping 9 weeks. And then he can sober us up in a story when he reflects about the loss of someone dear. His lessons are clear because he's a master of a theme, the main idea meant to sink into our souls. You listen to your patient's stories, Michael, almost daily, yes. And what you uncover is essentially for issuing recommendations. It's a tough question, but how would you describe the type of information that you receive in a client's story that's most helpful to you as a therapist?
Well, I'm really looking for a hook, if you will, something that was painful for them, but has a seed of something meaningful. And when I can kind of help them shift the way they look at it, it's the same story, but sometimes pain turned to the side can be inspiration or humor.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And one of the things that also impresses me about your stories, and really about that real quick analysis, is that, you know, vulnerability is really one of the greatest common human denominators. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very sensitive to that. You know, vulnerability doesn't always mean seriousness. It could be embarrassment, insults, humor, and the like. But you really do that so well. Now, theme and humor are important in both of your stories that you have for us tonight. Your first is about fishing with your grandfather.
Yep.
Tell us the story.
Growing up in a large family, getting to spend one-on-one time with a grandparent was really special. So when my grandfather announced that he was going to take me fishing with him, I was really excited. And this was really exotic. We were going to a pond in the middle of a cow pasture. And we arrived there just after sunrise, and it was really magical. We had to be careful walking in over the hills to not step any cow pies or the thorny bushes, but it was just really magical until we actually started fishing. I remember three things about that day. First was baiting the hook. Now, we had these long cane poles, and we used live minnows. Now, to bait the hook, you had to put the hook through the lip of the minnow. Now, neuroscientists will tell us that fish do not feel pain, but at 7 years old, that really felt strange and icky. The second thing I remember was we'd been there for a while, I guess, because we had a stringer of fish in the pond, and a turtle came up and was nipping at the fish. My grandfather took the turtle out, turned it upside down, and stomped on it. And I saw these brightly intestines oozing out, and it was really a terrible experience for me. And my grandfather explained, well, we had to do that because they were going to get our fish. So I acknowledged that, but it still felt really odd, didn't feel right to me. The third thing I remember was actually fishing. Now, these were long cane poles, so all you have to do, my pap told me, was watch the bobber. And if it goes down, then you pull. But I was seven and prone to daydreaming, so I didn't see the bobber when it went down. I didn't think of anything until I heard my grandfather yell, pull. So I pulled as hard as I could, and now the empty hook came back up, and the line went way back over my head and went into the thorny bushes. Now, recognizing it's not supposed to be there, I pulled back as hard as I could, but it was too late. The line was engaged in the thorny bushes. I look at my grandfather, and he looked at me, and he didn't say anything. He just walked slowly back to the thorny bushes to untangle my line. And I could feel shame rising in me. I had let him down. Now, at seven, I didn't know the word incompetent, but I knew the feeling. It's my benchmark still to this day of feeling incompetent. You've got to understand, my grandfather was never cruel, never mean. He gave me money to go to college. But from that moment on, somehow I could feel that incompetence when I was around him. Now, the summer after I finished college, I went over to his house almost every day to try to work off some of the debt that I owed him, and painting his garage roof, you know, some of the paint just spilled over, that incompetence. When I was trying to clean old caulk off the window, sometimes I would dig a little too deep and a big chunk of wood would dislodge from the window, and I could see him looking at me and wondering if I was really related to him. So one day we were out in his garden, and I saw something I had never seen before. There were two moths, and one landed right on top of the other one. What are they doing? I asked. And he looked at me and said, mating. And I can just imagine he's thinking, I sent this boy to college, and he doesn't know sex when he sees it. Now, that summer, my grandmother died, Pap's wife, and my mom said on that day, you know, Pap shouldn't be alone. Go to his house and go stay with him tonight. And I thought, this is going to be my opportunity to really bond. Maybe we'll talk about Granny. I'll be there for him. But that night, he just read his book until he went to bed. And then a few years later, when he was very old and frail, still wanting to bond with him, I came and I said, Pap, are you ready to die? Again, the incompetence. What do you think? He said. I didn't know. But I just wanted to bond with him, connect, and I never did. You know, we were just very different people. He was a man of the world. He worked in a factory. He was a woodworker. And me? I'm a psychotherapist. I collect philosophical quotes. I write haiku. We're just very different people. And now I'm a pap. I have a six-year-old granddaughter. And you know, whether she's a person of the world or whether she's more into ideas like me, I want to be available to her. But I know one thing for certain. I will never take her fishing.
You're a regular old man of the sea. That was a great story. I've heard that. But, you know, just like a good movie that you can see many different times, great story. I can hear that so many different times. And fishing, you know, there's something about fishing. When I was in college, I got a very unlikely job. I was a camp counselor for 4-H And, you know, I've never been on a farm. So that was one thing that was intriguing. And the kids that I had at this camp were really tough kids. I mean, they were middle school age kids, and they were, well, they were voted most likely to take a life. Okay. They were a tough group. And one of them had the wise idea that they wanted to go fishing. So I figured, how hard can that be, right? Take a worm, you take whatever, you put it on a hook. And we went down to the fishing pond, and they all looked at me knowing that I had no idea what I was doing, but neither did them. But I was the one stupid enough to try. So I'm taking this fishing rod, and I pull it back, and there the hook lands in my back, in my back. And nobody cares. They're all applauding. Hey, good job. Hey, nice job. Nice job. Nice job. That's what I got for 20 minutes. So fishing is one of those things that doesn't yield great memories. But, you know, there are a lot of lessons embedded in this narrative. And, boy, there are a lot. But if there was one most important message that you want us to take from it, what would that be?
I think it's just keep reaching out. You know, family is there to be connected with, and how you connect is going to be different, but just keep reaching out.
Keep trying. Yeah, yep. Keep trying. Yeah, one of the things that I've learned is that I think it's a little off base, but a parent has got to go out of his or her way to really find out what kids are interested in. Mm-hmm. You know, what one of the things that I never liked is when if I wanted to talk to an adult, a parent, about advice, they would always tell me, well, come in my room and we'll talk. I wanted to come in my room when I was comfortable. You know, it has to be their turf. But there's a lot there. It's about bonding. I love it. I have known Sheila Starks Phillips for a very long time, and I can say with confidence and conviction she is the real deal. Her career ranged from first grade teacher to zookeeper, author, and storyteller incarnate. She often combines music with her telling, especially for the younger audience, producing programs rich in involvement, which results in increased literacy, problem solving, and understanding morals. She's a past recipient of the very prestigious John Henry Falk Award, featured teller in festivals nationwide, and past president of the Tejas Storytelling Association. Sheila was also one of the earliest guests on this program. You remember Mr. Bun? Mr. Bun, I'm Mr. Bun. Remember that one? She brought her little guitar in, and it was pretty wild. I play that for my students sometimes. And served as a real catalyst in helping to make this program a Houston institution. Sheila, a few moments ago, I asked Michael about what he learns from patients when they tell stories. Interesting sort of a question, I guess. You know, members of the Guild rarely sit around and talk about their lives, right? And we talk about ourselves through our stories. Can you give us an example or two of what you've learned about Guild members from their stories? I'm talking things that you could actually say on the radio, you know, like one or two people or just collectively. What do you learn about people from the stories they tell?
Well, I don't know anyone's secrets, but I can say this. You don't really know someone just casually. Everyone is carrying some kind of burden, and these burdens are often revealed in the stories that they tell.
Well, I think that's really well said. You know, stories are, by nature, high-disclosing elements, you know? You've got to get to the core in order to tell a story. There's conflict. There's an arc. There's something going on there that tells a great deal about the teller. So I think you're absolutely right. Now, author Robert Fulghum of All I Really Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten fame is notoriously wise. His 13 books are a benchmark on how to live and how to care. It's really about becoming the best person we can be. And of his many quotes, my favorite is ferociously applicable to today's world. Don't worry that children never listen to you. Worry that they always are watching you, which I think is pretty, at least for me, it's amazing. Now, Sheila, your story comes from his 1989, It Was on Fire When I Laid Down on It. Without giving us a spoiler, what inspired you about this book?
Well, it's an easy one. It's the honesty of it, the parts that I think we can all relate to.
Yeah, real authentic. And I know that you contacted him, and I remember you telling us at a swap that you were surprised when he called you. Tell us about that.
Well, usually when I write someone, if I want to tell their story and I write a letter, I normally get an answer from their agent or from their publishing company.
Yes.
And when he called me himself on the phone, honestly, I almost fainted. Yeah. I was so excited
sure.
that he would do that.
Yeah. I felt that way about Cornel West. You know, no matter how we feel about him, when I brought him to the U of H, and he called me one night, and he said, "Hi, this is Cornel." I said, "You know, Cornel who?"
Yeah.
You know, and I realized this is Cornel West. He's actually calling me his friend. It's amazing how that feels, and who calls anybody anyway nowadays. So that had to be a great feeling. But it's really consistent with who he is and his philosophy and how he writes. Tell us a story.
Well, weddings sometimes turn out to be comedies. Now, they're not meant to be that way. It just happens. You're talking about a high-stake affair run by absolute amateurs that are under a lot of stress. And something almost always will go wrong. And it usually does. Now, this is my very favorite wedding story. And I think the reason I like it so much is because it is true. It's an absolutely true story. The main character in this story is not the bride, as you might ask or think. It's not the groom, it's not the minister, it's the mother of the bride. This otherwise highly intelligent, lovely, and gracious woman went completely berserk and came completely unhinged when the news of her daughter's betrothal came out. She just absolutely went nuts. Now, she wasn't mad, and sometimes the mothers of the bride are mad, quite on the contrary. She was absolutely overjoyed, and she almost succeeded in overwhelming everyone else with her joyfulness. Now, what nobody else knew was that this woman, from the moment that brand-new, just-born baby girl was placed in her arms, this woman had been planning a wedding. It was going to be a wedding fit for a princess. It was going to be a wedding that would make Cecil B. DeMille proud. She had 7 months to do it, and she set right to work. She was not going to waste a minute. She booked the church. She lined up the minister. She hired a 17-piece orchestra, brass and strings, because, well, you know, church organs are just too churchy. She got that all settled, and if that wasn't enough, the bridesmaids' dresses were specially created and made. The tuxes for the men and the boys in the wedding were purchased, not rented. And if that wasn't enough, the engagement ring was returned to the jewelers for a bigger stone, quietly subsidized by the mother of the bride. Everything that could be engraved was engraved. There were parties, parties, and more parties. There were breakfasts and brunches, lunches and dinners. There were high teas and dances. It just went on and on and on and on and on. Very early on, the father of the bride had prayed for an elopement, but that was simply not going to happen. She was in full swing. Now, the minister met with the young couple 3 different times. The mother of the bride called him every week, and she was in his office more times than the cleaning lady. The bride had picked out household goods from stores from New York to San Francisco, from Minneapolis to Houston. It just went on and on and on. Finally, it was time for the wedding. Guests arrived at the church that night dressed in formal clothing. The church itself looked spectacular. There were flowers everywhere you looked, and the scent of the blooms filled the sanctuary. The 17-piece orchestra, brass and strings, was up high in the choir loft, and they were playing beautiful music. There were enough candles lit to bring the whole place up to daylight standards. It looked beautiful. Now, when it was time for the mother of the bride to walk down the aisle, she did it on the arm of her oldest son, who was serving as one of the groomsmen. She did it like she looked like an opera diva on opening night. She strolled down that aisle. She looked to the right and to the left. She smiled. She sighed. She gave little waves to special friends. And when she took her seat, no mother of the bride had ever taken her seat with more satisfaction. She had done it. The music began and changed the volume, and 9 bridesmaids began to lockstep down the aisle. And you heard me right. I said 9 bridesmaids, soft and chiffon. When the minister gave the signal and the guests all rose to their feet and turned toward the back to see the bride make her entrance, and she was preceded by 4 junior bridesmaids, also soft and chiffon, chunking rose petals in every direction, and 2 tiny little gentlemen dressed in tux, each carrying a ring. What you noticed about the bride when you looked was not her dress, although it was very spectacular. What you noticed about the bride was her face, because her face was actually whiter than the dress. This young woman had been dressed for hours, if not days. She did not have an ounce of adrenaline left in her body. Now, while she and her father were waiting for the march of the maidens, it seemed to go on and on and on. They had waited in the reception area, which was beautifully decorated with flowers everywhere you looked and a zillion candles lit. The tables were laden with food. The bride, absentmindedly, had walked among the tables, and first she had eaten some of those little pink and white and green butter mints. Then she dug around in the bowls of nuts, and she ate out all of the cashews. She sampled a couple of the cheese balls, had some glazed almonds, ate a sausage that was on a frilly little toothpick, had a couple of shrimp that were wrapped in bacon, and then a fancy cracker that was laden down with liver pate. Then she washed all this down with a glass of pink champagne that her father had given her to settle her nerves. So what you saw walking down the aisle, clutching her father's arm in a death grip, was a human grenade with the pin pulled. When she got even with her beaming mother, the bride threw up. Now, I'm not talking about a ladylike little burp into her handkerchief. No, I'm talking about a full-out throw-up. She hosed the whole front of the sanctuary, hitting 2 bridesmaids, the minister, the groom, one of the tiny little gentleman ring-bearers. And once she had gotten rid of all those hors d'oeuvres and the pink champagne and the last of her dignity, she had collapsed in her father's arms. Her mother had screamed and fainted dead away, draping herself over the back of a pew like a discarded Raggedy Ann doll. Now, I am perfectly sure about all the details I'm giving you because the mother of the bride had provided 3 video cameras to record every single thing that happened in this event. Well, the smell of fresh wretch mixed with guttering candles was just too much for a lot of people, and those with weak stomachs had headed for the exits. Now, what happened next? Well, it was like a fire drill at the front of the church. It would have made the Keystone Cops proud. Heroic groomsmen rushed to the aid of everyone. There were bridesmaids crying, many bridesmaids squalling. The groom himself had sat right down where he was. He was too stunned to do anything else. It was a terrible thing. Nobody knew quite what to do, but they were rushing around in every direction. A curious thing, though. The 17-piece orchestra, brass and strings, who were way up in the choir loft, were totally unaware of all this activity going on, and they had continued to play beautiful, beautiful music. Well, what did they do? Well, they invited the remaining guests to retire to the reception area, which they gladly, gladly did, although I suspect they did not eat as much as they might have otherwise. They rushed the bride off. They cleaned her up. Someone even found a toothbrush. They dressed her out in a bridesmaid's dress. She was comforted over and over, and she was kissed and hugged and told over and over how much she was loved by her groom, and she will always love him for that. Now, they reassembled down in front of the church. This time, the 17-piece orchestra, brass and strings, did not play. They had one lone flute that played. The vows were said. Everybody cried. Well, people often cry at weddings, but this time, I'm serious. Everybody cried because the groom held his bride in a tender embrace throughout the whole service. Well, that young couple have lived as happily ever after as most people do. They've been married for 12 years and have three rambunctious children, but that's not the end of the story. On their 10th anniversary, there was a party held. Best friends and family were invited. The table was filled with food and drink, and there were three TVs that were set up. Remember those three video cameras that the mother of the bride had provided? Well, the footage from all three cameras were played on those TVs all at the same time. It was hilarious. People hooted and hollered and carried on, and it got a little gross with the stop action and the running narrative. But the biggest hollering and applause happened when the camera zoomed in on the father of the bride, who was grinning from ear to ear as he watched others trying to revive his unconscious wife. That whole time, there were only two people smiling in the whole place. One was the mother of the groom, and the other was the father of the bride. And who gave this big party? Well, the mother of the bride, of course. That lovely, gracious woman had finally been able to forgive everybody involved, and she was finally able to forgive herself. And that's what is called grace. And that is exactly why that smiling man has been married to her for 40 years and why her daughter loves her still.
That is a beautiful story. Very descriptive.
No
yes, prop.
Is.
Very yes, descriptive. Now, you know, the same question I asked Michael. This one is a little bit more explicit in the sense that you talk about it being about grace. But what else? What else should we extract from that?
Well, we all make mistakes and do crazy, crazy things, and you just have to be able to forgive yourself. And sometimes it takes a very long time to do that.
Yeah, it really does. It's, you know, Mark Twain said it best. He said, "Show me someone who knows what's funny, and I'll show you someone who knows what isn't." You know, the idea of seeing something that humorous and learning something from it is really not an easy thing, but yeah, it's all about forgiveness.
Yeah.
This is Hank Rubicek with Tatiana Gago, and we don't want you to forget that you're listening too. So What's Your Story? With guest storytellers from the Houston Storytellers Guild, Alan Gardner Atkinson, Sheila Starks Phillip, and Michael Winters on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Okay, quick question to all of you. I mentioned that Fulgham, of course, wrote Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Name one thing that you learned as a child that you will hold forever true. Just one thing. Curious. Alan, what do you think?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. I would say always think before you get angry.
Okay, that's a good one. Here's the reason I'm asking this. You know, we're living in a world where a lot of people really don't think. And I'm not sure that they understand some of the fundamental values that we learned as kids. Yeah. Michael, what do you think?
Stay in line.
Stay in line. Sheila, have you got one?
I do have one. Share your crayons and your lunch.
Share your crayons and your lunch. I like that one. You know, hold hands, cookies and milk are good for you, just like this is right out of the book. Tatiana, have you got one?
Listen to your mother, because 11 out of 10 times she is right.
11 out of 12 times. Okay, that was a good answer, which explains why you're in graduate school. So before you tell us about storytelling in Houston, tell us about your first week in grad school.
Well, it is a lot. I've been overwhelmed, and I felt a lot of emotions within 3 days. But overall, it is something that I'm extremely excited for.
Well, we're proud of you, and you are going to be great. I want you to talk about storytelling now, because I don't think people realize what a great hub this is.
And I love that our sponsor is spotlighted tonight, because it's time for our listeners to put voices to the group.
Yes.
The Guild hosts a story swap the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset, directly across from Rice University. And it's a great place to listen, tell, and talk about storytelling to a supportive group of like-minded people. The next swap is August 27th, and for more information about the monthly swaps and the Guild's events, go to www.houstonstorytellers.org. And while you're there, why not become a member? You can definitely do it online. And don't leave their webpage before clicking on radio program on the menu to enjoy hundreds of shows since 2008. So What's Your Story was the first storytelling scene in Houston, and it is a seed that helped grow our storytelling community. So please enjoy our past programs and continue to tune in every week for live stories and connect us to each other. And if you don't have a radio, that's no problem, because you can catch us online anywhere on the globe at www.kpft.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and yes, you can say that we are all over the place. And if you have program ideas, questions about storytelling, suggestions for guest tellers, or tell us why you'd be a great guest, drop us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you. And if you want to take your storytelling interest to the next level, the Tejas Storytelling Association and National Storytelling Network are waiting for you to become a member. Check them out online. And our friends at the Moss hold their monthly swap on the second Tuesday of the month at Warehouse Life. The next one is on September 10th, and the theme is Lessons. It's a great place to listen to wonderful stories and to some that need work. In short, listen to lots of storytellers and start telling stories.
Great advice and thorough report as always. Thank you, Tatiana. Next week, guest host and our friend Eric Heen will assemble some storytellers from several faiths whose stories about human tolerance, a very timely theme, will prove how the power of stories unite us. Ellen Gardner Atkinson is another one of those stalwart tellers whose unshakable talent is nothing short of remarkable. He can craft a story from a word, add a context, and he'll create conflict. In short, he can build a story from virtually nothing and make it shine. It's his prolific background as an actor that feeds his love for the story. Stories like The Caine Mutiny, The Firebugs, and The Balcony, to name a few. But it's his role of storyteller that I know best. Ellen effortlessly fuses personal experience with the wit of a folktale and the drama of a soap opera to create a story style no one, and I mean no one, can match. Ellen, you have directed as well, correct?
Yes, yeah. I've acted, I think, in about 100 plays now, but I've directed 29.
Wow, okay. I didn't know there were that many. I know you directed Tennessee Williams.
Not recently, but I've directed two Williams shows. I directed Glass Menagerie and Streetcar Named Desire.
Fabulous, fabulous. How is directing different from acting? You know, we have a lot of people who are interested about, we have a lot of call-ins, mm-hmm. At least emails, who ask, well, you have some actors on. How is that different from directing?
Uh-huh. Well, it's a whole different process, really. If it's an actor, basically, you're learning your lines and you're thinking about what would I do if I were this character in this situation. Directing is much more a management job. You're dealing not only with the acting, but with the designs and costumes. And you're basically a set of eyes that watch the actor and coaches the actor.
I love your stories because they often appear as a puzzle. Is it personal or fictional or a blend of both? And this also explains the reason that the story that you're about to tell was so successful. You told this in the Liars Contest, one of the signature events held by the Guild every April. A good lie by judging standards must be plausible to a degree. And that's where that, you know, sense of, gee, did it ever really happen? And that's what you do so well, that plausibility. Is it true or is it real? Is it Memorax, you know, the little commercial? Let's jump into your story, and I think listeners will know what I mean.
Good evening. My name is E. Howard Hunt, the former CIA operative, best known for my participation in the 1972 burglary of the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate Hotel in Washington, D.C. The story I'm about to tell you is still classified top secret, but I feel I can betray my oath never to reveal because I've just learned that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have hacked the CIA computers, so the information will likely become public soon in any case. Understand, this story is not political. I've given up politics. It's merely a history lesson. As far as politics are concerned, well, I like to eat ice cream with my friends, so I guess that makes me an ice cream socialist. Some of you may recall the 1971 summit meeting in Moscow between American President Richard Nixon and Soviet Secretary General Leonid Brezhnev. Historians generally agree that Nixon and his Secretary of State Henry Kissinger were fairly successful in their negotiation with the Russians. They got agreements on trade, they helped American farmers by selling millions of tons of wheat to the Russians, and they even negotiated the first SALT, or Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. But there was one thing that President Nixon wanted very badly that he did not get at that meeting: the Kremlin's secret recipe for borscht. One day, CIA Director Richard Helms called me into his office. The president was with him. The president said to me, "Mr. Hunt, as you probably know, our recent negotiations in Moscow were for the most part a success. However, we had one major failing. Our first night in Moscow at the official state dinner, the Kremlin kitchen served borscht. This borscht was amazing, the best borscht I'd ever had. It was absolutely delicious. After the dinner, my wife, Pat, asked me if I could get the recipe for her so she could serve it at the White House. The next day at our negotiations, I asked Secretary General Brezhnev for the recipe. And he became outraged and said, 'How could you expect us to give up such an important state secret?' I made several offers. I offered his whole embassy staff in Washington season tickets to the senator's baseball games. I offered concessions on strategic arms limitation, unilateral reductions in nuclear missiles. I even offered to sell them American laundry detergent. But that dirty commie rat would not give up the recipe." Then Director Helms said, "Hunt, we think you're the only agent who can do this job. Your mission is to sneak into the Kremlin kitchen and steal the recipe for borscht." I was not very happy to have this assignment. Working behind the Iron Curtain was always tricky business. I was issued a false passport, a disguise, a .45 caliber pistol, and a secret camera that looked just like a Soviet Communist Party lapel pin. I boarded a submarine in Pensacola and was dropped on the coast of Finland, close to the Russian border. I went to Moscow by train. When I arrived in the Soviet capital, I disguised myself as a Soviet collective farm worker and proceeded to the Kremlin kitchen door, pushing a cart full of turnips and potatoes. When I arrived, the head chef came out to greet me himself. He was very angry. He said, "How has it taken you so long to get here? I've got to make the borscht for today's Politburo meeting. If I don't have it done on time, they'll send me to the Gulag Archipelago." He and his assistant left and took the cart with them, and I was left alone there in the Kremlin kitchen. I began to look around, and I found an office just off the kitchen. I went inside, and there was no one there. There was a wall safe. It, of course, was locked, and I didn't have the combination. But I used a secret CIA silent explosive to blow the lock open. And inside was a file box that was labeled "Secret Kremlin Recipes, Authorized Personnel Only." I opened the box and started to thumb through it. The recipe for borscht was filed under B. I took the Soviet Party Badge lapel pin camera, took pictures of the recipe card, along with all the other Kremlin secret recipes. I was about to make my getaway when I heard a voice out in the hall. It was Leonid Brezhnev himself, and he was saying, "I tell you, I know there is an American spy in the building. We must find him." And then I heard the voice that I recognized as the KBG's top agent, Boris Badenov. And he said, "To me, this sounds like an assignment for which the Americans would send moose and squirrel." I hid under a desk in the office, and I listened until footsteps walked by. Then I decided to make a run for it. I ran out of the kitchen out into the courtyard, and there, facing me, was Boris Badenov's partner, Natasha, holding an AK-47 pointed right at me, and two other KBG agents with guns. I took out my cyanide capsule and was about to pop it into my mouth, when suddenly I heard a stampede of hooves, and into the courtyard came Bullwinkle the Moose. Unbeknownst to me, CIA Director Helms had sent backup for me. The moose impaled Natasha on his horns and trampled the other two KBG agents. Then Rocky the Flying Squirrel appeared and said, "Grab onto my paw," and we went flying across Moscow, landed outside a safe house on the other side of town, where I spent the night before returning to America the next day. Pat Nixon got her recipe. The CIA gave me a medal. And I do apologize to everyone for that little misunderstanding at the Watergate Hotel a year later.
You know, I don't know how you keep these stories straight. I mean, this is a cluster of, you know, boomer-friendly features. It requires a select audience in many ways because the nuances are so intriguing. How do you document your story ideas? That's always a fascinating question for me, asking a teller like you.
Well, in some cases, I really haven't done a good enough job doing it. There are a couple of stories that I can think of that I'd still like to tell, but I really can't remember enough of them to tell them. But a lot of them I eventually write down on paper.
Yeah, yeah. But there has to be some sort of a catalyst in terms of, you know, where do you get these ideas? I mean, are you watching a rerun of, you know, Bullwinkle, Jay Moose, and there comes the story? Or,
well, this one, I think the idea came from meeting a man who I won't really tell you much about him because he probably wouldn't like me to, but he was at one time involved in some intelligence work. And I think talking to him really gave me the germinal idea for the story. But really, my process really is a process often of asking questions and thinking up potential answers. I think anything you can ask a question about is something you can write a story about.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great illustration. Give us an example of one question.
Okay. What would the Americans want to steal from the Russians that would be funny?
Okay. All right. Gotcha.
And the answer I came up with was borscht.
Very good. I like it. Okay. Gotcha. You know, I many listeners know I'm a docent at the Holocaust Museum, and one of the new sections in the museum is called Young Diarists. You know, Anne Frank was not the only young lady who kept a diary. There were hundreds of teenagers who kept diaries during their time in concentration camp. Some of them knew that they were going to perish. And I was reading some of these the other day. And, you know, there's a difference between a diarist and a memorist. A memorist is someone who writes down details that they choose, that they want to be remembered. Literally, a diarist writes daily, in which case things just sort of manifest into a story that you least expect, right? And I've tried that. I've tried that myself in creating stories. And I find that if I don't think about what I'm writing down, in other words, taking the diarist approach, I create these stories from the most incidental episodes. And it's just amazing how we do create stories from virtually nothing. But I love the idea of asking a question, because questions beg a response, and that response is formulated into a story. I know we all have our own techniques, but people who listen to the show frequently want to know if they actually have stories. You know, I make it very clear, everybody has a story. Mm-hmm. You're born a blank page, and every day you've got some episode mm-hmm. to fill those blank pages. We're all stories. Mm-hmm. That was a wonderful story. Yeah. I love these creative avenues. Mm-hmm. Dr. Winters, I'll call you Aquaman because you've got another little ditty about water, okay? This time you are taking your stepdaughters to Galveston.
That's right. Just weeks after a new marriage, I decided to take my 10 and 13-year-old stepdaughters on a trip to the beach. The new bride had to work that day, so it was just going to be the three of us. We got up early, and by 10 a.m., the sun was already high and hot in a cloudless sky as we arrived at the seawall. We could smell the salt air and heard the gulls talking to each other, squawking. We pulled up along the seawall, and wanting to be very careful on this new venture with my new stepdaughters, locked my wallet and my spare key in the glove compartment, and then locked the doors of the car. And we went down to the water, and we got in the water immediately, and it felt so good. It was so cool, and we just felt the waves just lightly lapping, and we walked out. I was up to about my waist, and the girls were up to almost their necks, and everything was going great. And, you know, I had this sensation, though. You know, as a newlywed, I could still notice the feeling of the ring, my wedding band, on my finger. And I could also notice the sensation of the ring leaving my hand in the surf. So it just happened. It couldn't have gone far. So I alerted the girls, and we started immediately an intense search. Now, if I've given you the idea that the water in Galveston is that crystal aquamarine that you see in the Bahamas commercials, I was mistaken. It was very dark. We couldn't see inches into it, let alone several feet. After a prolonged search, we realized that we were not likely to find the ring. So we returned to the beach, a little dejected, to make our next plan. Did I mention that I had put the car key in my swimming trunks in that special little pouch with a little fold over it just to make sure that you never lose your key? Well, apparently those don't work in the Gulf of Mexico. So here we were. We had a beach umbrella and three towels, and that was it. So we haul ourselves across the seawall to a Jamaican restaurant and try to plead our case to see if we could use their phone, because there was no cell phones in this day and also no quarter in our pocket. They did let us call AAA, and the AAA operator said, "I'll be glad to put out a tow truck. Just give me your AAA membership number." Tried to explain that the AAA membership number was in the wallet, which was in the car. One of the girls overhearing this said, "Call Mom." I said, "No." I was not about to let her know of what was happening at this time. Eventually, I convinced the operator to dispatch a tow truck, and the tow truck came. We got in the car. And we still had the afternoon. So the girls wanted to rent boogie boards, and I thought that was a great idea. They were going to do that, and I was going to sit under the umbrella and read. I had failed to bring a spade to dig a hole for the umbrella, but I was able to kind of just stab the umbrella into the ground, and it was working pretty well, until a gust of wind came along, and the umbrella fell over. I got up, and I re-stabbed and tried to put it a little bit deeper, and returned to reading until another gust of wind came along and knocked the umbrella down again. Now, the frustration of this day had been building, And I took it out on that umbrella. I started bashing the umbrella again and again into the sand, not knowing until later that my daughters had been watching from the ocean. I felt a lot better after that. And, you know, my daughters were able to see me. I'd lost a lot. I'd lost a ring, I'd lost a key, and I'd lost my cool. But I never took it out on them. 24 years later, that story is still one of our favorite family memories.
You and water don't seem to get along very well.
Well,
I'm surprised you take showers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, yeah.
You know, these are just stories from my life. So yeah, these just happen to have water. I can't tell you everything that happens.
Yeah. You might want to think about dry ground. You might want to think about, tennis. You ever play tennis? Yeah. Great. Very, very good. But you do a great job at really, interconnecting family. And your stories, even though they sound weird and a little funny and negative isn't really the word, but they're not terribly upbeat in terms of the consequence. They're wonderfully upbeat because it's all about bonding. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any difference where you are.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any difference.
That's really it. We did bond. It wasn't my plan for how we would bond, but they still remember that trip and how I, was totally, incompetent, and yet they were still safe.
Yeah.
And they could see that even when I was really frustrated, I wasn't hurting them, and so they could accept me.
Yeah, it's also great that you bond with your stepkids. You know, that doesn't sound very profound, but a lot of people don't. You know, they just don't. Mm-hmm. And that's wonderful, wonderful that you do. It says so much about you. All of these stories say so much about each of you tonight. Now, this is going to sound like a multiple choice question, Michael. I don't mean it to, but do you let a story unfold before determining its meaning? Or do you find meaning in your story before letting it unfold? In other words, you think about, what do I want it to mean? And then you tell the story. I'm going to tell the story, and then whatever it means, it means.
Yeah, I think it's for me, more just kind of capturing some moments and kind of bracketing them and saying, oh, that's a story. And then finding the meaning later. I'm not looking for a meaning. I'm looking for what's the story. And then usually when I look at it, it's like, oh, there's something relevant there.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I'm not really sure what I do. I guess I just tell a story and think that maybe it has meaning. You know, if it has meaning to us, it's going to have meaning to somebody else. That's what resonating is all about. Mm-hmm. But it's just interesting question. I do want to get back to the guild for just a moment. You know, a guild is defined as a group with a common goal, but true to the historical roots of storytelling. A guild is conceived as an association of craftsmen or merchants, often having considerable power. I say that because the term guild is used for a reason. It's because it's old. It's a long time. We're old, some older than others. But you know what? We are good, and we have been around a while. And that's what guilds do. I want to make it very clear to our listeners that the Houston Storytellers Guild is our sponsor, but it's also a series of friendships. And it's a great place to meet people, not only to tell stories, but to meet people who want to tell stories. And that's a little bit of a distinction, a little bit different. And I need all of you to know that. Sheila, you've been around the Houston Storytellers Guild a long time. You're the oldest member here. You've been around the longest. Tell us a little bit about how it was born, please.
I love I'm always referred to as the oldest.
Well, member. The oldest member, right?
Okay.
It began,
there's a couple named Jim Omart and Eileen Hatcher found their way to the National Storytelling Festival one year in Jonesboro, Tennessee. And they were so taken with this new storytelling revival that on their return to Houston, they contacted a woman named Janine Passini-Beekman, who at that time was a librarian, and they launched the Houston Storytellers Guild. And it was a slow to launch because people were new to that. Storytelling was a lost art form, and It was revived in that little town in Jonesboro, Tennessee, by a fellow who was the mayor of mm-hmm. that town. And that first festival they had, the people sat on hay bales and the tellers stood in the back of a pickup truck. So it has come a long way. For Houston, that started in the early to mid-'80s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has a very rich history. You know, we can't talk about price on Pacifica, but we can give a word problem. So it's 1/4 or 1/4 of 100. In other words, you'll need 4 of these to make 100. If you have 4 slices of pizza and I eat one, what percentage did I just consume? Right? Do, 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 do. You get the idea. It's cheap. So joining the guild won't break the bank. Speaking of Pacifica, you are listening to it on 90.1 FM Houston, Fueled for Peace. I have posted the guild's webpage and also Sheila's webpage and a few other goodies for you on our So What's Your Story Facebook. So What's Your Story is the first program in Houston devoted to storytelling. The Houston Storytellers Guild is the first name when it comes to belonging to a group of tellers in Houston. We look forward to seeing you at our swaps the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 at Temple Emmanuel. Thank you, Sheila Starks Phillips, Alan Gardner Atkinson, and Michael Winters for your stories, your support, and for your friendship. It's been, I think, a terrific show. And you know, I just every time I do the show, which has been a long time now, it never gets old. It always gets new. It always is fresh. And it's because of folks like you who make it as much fun as it is. Right, Tatiana?
Absolutely.
You bet. Now, don't you dare touch that dial, because Lars and the Tennyson Tape Deck is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters. I can't talk after, you know, 8:55. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Dr. Hank, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.
The 2019 local station board elections are underway. Visit elections.pacifica.org for candidates' written statements, video cards, and debates. As of August 15th, your ballot will come in one of three forms: an email ballot, a brightly colored postcard, or, if you requested it, a paper ballot from Honest Ballot. If you cannot find your ballot, please fill out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org. Members in need of a paper ballot can leave a voicemail at 510-854-9663. Paper ballot replacements will be issued through October 7th. All ballots must be received by October 15th, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.